Well, I want to thank everybody for, well, actually, some people returned. That's amazing. Always amazing. My name is Russell Spatz. Once again, I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found necessary to take a drink, nor have I taken one since January 25th, 1981. And for that, I'm grateful. Very grateful. Always grateful. And I'm a member of the Carl Gables group, and I'm excited tonight because I get to talk to you guys about a little bit of my experience and what's happened to me in the last 32, almost 33 years with this deal. I'm going to share a little bit about my experiences. I'm going to share some things out of the book and some other books. I'm excited to see Eric that actually came back after picking up his white chip. It's amazing. You know, I'm pretty iconoclastic. I'm a little controversial. I understand that. I think, what did I talk about, the Bible? I read from the Bible last week. I think I mentioned Jesus or something. I broke all the rules. You know, I do a lot of, I'm going to do a little bit of that. You know, here's the problem. You see, I'm like a shark. When I sense blood in the water, it gets me crazy. I don't know with you, you were here for your first meeting, you know, when I was doing all that stuff. And we were talking about, one of the things I was talking about is sometimes you got to see these things from a distance. I was talking to Victoria about that because Victoria has over 30 years. And some of the things that you, and not that in any way I completely know this thing, right? I just know a few things. I've learned a few things. Believe me, you can stay sober and get quite happy by just knowing just a couple of things. I used to know everything. I was miserable. When I knew everything, I was miserable. Now I know like three things, and everything's fine. But as long as I stick with those three things, you know, I can talk to you about those things. And what I want to do is sort of connect the dots, but sometimes you don't really see the connections between these things until you live them. And you don't live them until you're going through life and experiencing trials and have to work them. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you probably have to work them like 15, 20,000 times in order to say, whoa, I think I may have a drinking problem. You know, that's the way it works with all these deals. You know, how much, listen, I don't know about you, but I didn't have like one ice cube and a bad Saturday night and said, gee, I think I'm an alcoholic. You know, I mean, I had to ruin my life with alcohol before I was broken and came in here and I said, I think I had a drinking problem. And even then, all I could say is, you don't understand. If only I was a yes butter. I was trying to excuse myself out of it. I mean, how much do you have to be hurt? How many times do you have to learn as an alcoholic where our chief characteristic is defiance before you actually follow directions and admit something? You know, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all his consequences, whatever that is, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. And I don't know about you, but what I want here is I want what these guys had between 1935 and 1939. I want to experience much of heaven. I want to be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. I want everything this program has to offer. I don't want just mere sobriety where you're 15 years sober, like I've seen guys and sponsor got in here, and they're hanging in there. I'm hanging in there, you know, one blessed day at a time. I don't want to be running to AA meetings like I did for many years. Nothing wrong with this. It's part of the deal because I needed a meeting because I needed to talk about what happened because I had a crummy week. I had a crummy year. I was at a meeting before I came here over at the Old Cutler. They have like an Alive Again meeting, and one guy was saying, I had a horrible week. You know, I don't know, you have a horrible every second, but that's what he thought. I had a horrible week. I said, I want to say, are you including like here now with me? I mean, is that part of the deal? I mean, you didn't have a horrible week, but that's the way we think as alcoholics. We're nuts, and I don't want to have horrible weeks, horrible years, horrible hours, you know what I mean? I want that release. I want to see what that guy had, Bill Dodson, when he says, I knew there was something more, something I haven't got, something that a person ought to have. And the bottom line is, in order to get that stuff, there may be, as we said last week, we talked about further surrenders. It may be more than just saying, I can't drink anymore, or I have a problem with drinking, or I have an alcohol problem. You may have a problem with everything. I drank because no woman, no amount of sex, no suit of clothes, no car, no money, no prestige, no position ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. And so that's why I drank it. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The effect, because they're restless, irritable, and discontented. Now listen, this is AA gospel. This is not my opinion. I mean, you're entitled to your own opinion, you're not entitled to your own facts. This is a book on which we agree on. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not about the wisdom of the rooms or what the wisdom of well people's anonymous. This is what's written in the black and white. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They are, and if you're an alcoholic like me, that means you are restless, you're irritable, you're discontented, sober. That's the way you are, unless you can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. So if you want to know why you feel the way you do and why you are the way you are, you feel the way you do and you are the way you are because you're alcoholic, because you suffer from alcoholism, which is, quite frankly, not completely unique or different from the regular people in the outside world. If you see regular people in the outside world and sometimes they look sort of nutty to you and kind of crazy and they blow up and do crazy things and shoot people, do wacky things, it's because they probably have the same thing we have. It's only like the booze doesn't work for them. You know, but you see, here's the problem. They say the alcohol is, but it's the consumption of alcohol is but a symptom of our disease, right? It's a hell of a symptom. It's what gets us in here. It says our real disease centers in our mind, not our body. It's the way we're built. It's the way we think. But the problem is they don't arrest you for driving while drinking, but while thinking. They don't. Somebody at that door. What is going on here? They're coming at me from all sides. Get the door. Okay. Go around. Tell them to go around. They don't arrest you. They don't arrest you for driving while saying. They don't arrest you for. They don't tell you to get out of the car because I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry, sir, but I sense that you're driving while feeling sorry for yourself. You know, I'm sorry, sir. Why did you stop me? Because you're depressed. You know. Why? Excuse me, sir. I think you were coveting. You know, that girl over there or lusting. They arrest you for the alcohol stuff. That's what makes the life pour apart. The first thing when you're arresting. When you're drinking too much alcohol, the wheels fall off the car, unless you're rich enough and wealthy enough to buy the attorney or somehow manage to not have it happen. But eventually even that falls off, whether you're Michael Jackson, whatever. Something happens, it blows up, it looks like it's the alcohol. It looks like it's the drugs, but it's not the drugs. It's not the alcohol. That's what brings you to your knees. That's what breaks you. What it is, it's why you drink, why you need to drink in the first place. And so even though alcohol worked better than any girl, any romance, any money, any of that stuff, all that stuff works too. I'm addicted to all, the women work too. The cars work too. The blouses work. The haircuts work. All the vanity, it works too. So as soon as you, and you want to know something, with the same deleterious effect. So what happens, so you get rid of the alcohol. So now you're spending more money than you make to buy things you don't even need, to impress people you don't even like, and you don't even know why you find yourself in these situations and why you're broke all the time, because you're buying stuff you don't even need, because you need to have that blouse, because you need to have that car, because you run around worrying about, because what if I lose this, or what if I lose that, or what if I don't get this? What does it matter what the addiction is? You're just addicted to everything in this world. All you do is, listen, you want to know why you're upset? Because you're upsettable. You're upset because you're, and you know why you're upsettable? Because all you do is think about stuff. Whenever you're upset, you never think about God. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what it says? It says, we experienced much of heaven, we've been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. It says, the great fact is this, nothing less. We've had a revolutionary experience in our life where we completely think differently. He says, the central fact of our life today is that we believe. We are absolutely sure that our Creator, God, lives in our hearts. He is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. The central fact of our life today is God, which is probably why, if you read the big book, you see all this stuff about God. Have you ever noticed that? It says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come. See to it that your relationship with him is right. It doesn't say see to it that you got a new car, does it? It doesn't say see to it that you got a good job, does it? It doesn't say see to it that you're having sex every night, does it? It doesn't say Viagra will fix you, does it? I mean, the world tells you that. The world says that to you. But the big book doesn't say. It says see to it your relationship with him is right. If your relationship with him is right, great events will happen to you. And it says it many different ways throughout the book. Only we don't take it seriously. We think, well, that's sort of nice, but it's more like a psychological problem. It's all more like a psychiatric program, you know, because that's what we want to believe. So we sort of read that, and what we ultimately find out after you've been around for 30 years is this, you know why? Because believing that, or having that talking to us about that makes us feel, most of us, uncomfortable. We feel uncomfortable around religious people. We feel uncomfortable with the God thing. I feel more comfortable with the God, just tell me how to get a car. Just tell me how to get a job. You know, I know what my problem is. My problem is I don't have a job. I don't have a car. If I only had more money, I know what the problem line is. Give me $1 million, I'll be okay. Give me $1 million, I'll destroy myself. just like everybody destroyed, because I've never been okay. So we feel uncomfortable. So we want to hear about the stuff that makes us comfortable. But the real meat and potatoes, the things that will stay, keep you sober for 30 years and 40 years, and not only sober, but emotionally sober, where you don't have unhealthy dependencies, are the things that make you ready for this? Uncomfortable. The truth will make you uncomfortable. The reason you hung around the people you hung out with, which actually hurt you, is because you liked them because they made you feel comfortable. You know why? Because they agreed with you. The reason you fired that sponsor who you didn't like is because she wasn't nice to you, because she told you things that made you feel bad. So you went out and found a sponsor who could be your friend. You know, I mean, I understand the way we think. We'll do anything to avoid confrontation or people telling us things that we don't want to hear. That's the way I am. So if that's the way I am, I'm pretty sure that's the way you guys are. And so what I'm going to talk about tonight is a little bit about, and this is cool because it's Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur in the Jewish religion, you know what that is? It's the Day of Atonement. This is the day where what happens is the people, the Israelites, what they did was they had a high priest, and for all their sins, that's what defects of character is called, the thing with the sins, all their sins, the high priest would go in and sacrifice into the Holy of Holies and sacrifice the blood of a lamb without blemish, you know what I mean? And that was supposed to, what that did was that absolved the sins of the Israelites, that nation, for like a year. And they had a holiday. It's one of the most sacred holidays of the year. This is Yom Kippur. So it's pretty good that tonight we're talking about the eighth and ninth step, which has to do with atonement, repentance, forgiveness, and being forgiven. It has to do with that stuff. Yeah, please turn off your phones if you could do that for me, because, you know, I'm 64 and I got two neurons working. I'll just get all over the place. So that's, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself and the deal and everything like that. I'm going to try to see whether I can to connect the dots for you, okay? The way I see it after 30. I'm just going to try to share what's going on with me. And it's exciting that Eric's back again. You know, you're always here that, you know, if you're too tough with this stuff, the new people don't want to come back. The new people, I'm doing these steps also at the Boulevard Club. Some gal with 6 years came up to me. She says, you don't know me. A nice gal named Lara. And she said, my first meeting, I came in during your step series. I'll never forget it. It changed my deal. And I'm not saying that it has anything to do with me. But what I know through my experience is that these things, the way I'm telling you these things, that, you know, people with 10 years and 12 years like to think you chase newcomers away. I think what happens is people with 5 or 6 or 7 years, the reason they get disturbed when you get a little bit too tough with this stuff is it's not because it's chasing people away, because let's face it, anybody who gets chased out of an AA room because of something they heard probably hasn't drank enough. You understand? Because I'll tell you, you know, the truth is, if you're going to hang around AA as long as you hear the stuff you want to hear, you understand what I'm saying? You ain't going to be, you're going to drink anyway. You're not going to get a sponsor. You're not going to listen. You're going to end up drinking anyway. The bottom line is, it's not the newcomer that gets disturbed by these messages. They're looking for relief. They're looking for the truth. They're not looking for some sort of easy and so on. The people that get disturbed are the people with 5 or 10 years that don't really want to do this stuff, because if I'm true, then they have to change. And they've already surrendered. They've already, see, what happens in this program is you reach a point, it may be 5 years, it may be 10 years, it may be, we all reach that point. I reached that point where we pretty much we've surrendered, we've given up enough. We've given up enough. There ain't going to be no more surrender. You understand? I got 10 years. I'm teaching the steps. You know, I'm doing okay with my business. I got a wife. I got 3 kids. You know, I'm going to meetings. I'm doing all this stuff. I've decided. Now, I don't say this out loud. I don't announce it to the room, but I've done my surrendering. I've changed enough. I'm okay now. I'm in the management mode of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm basically not going to meetings because I need means. I'm going to meetings to help people, which is okay, which is good. And the bottom line is people are patting me on the back. They're asking me questions. I'm sponsoring people. I'm in the management mode of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing is once you start coasting, it's easy to let up on a spiritual program of action and rest on your laurels, but you're headed for trouble if you do. And somewhere along the line, you emotionally break down. The breakdown happens. Something happens, and then all of a sudden you go from the management mode to the mode again where there's more surrender. Unfortunately, sometimes people don't surrender and they end up drinking. Sometimes it's not just an emotional jag. Sometimes it's a drink at 15 years. It's a drink at 17 years. It's a drink at 9 years. And then maybe you make it back and maybe you don't make it back. And even if you make it back, you're in a weaker position, a weaker situation. So this surrender thing is so important all the way through this deal. So I want to share a little bit about how this, what this whole concept in 8 and 9 about why it's so important, what it has to do with repentance and atonement and forgiveness and how this sort of works with me. I'm not one of these guys. I'm not a how-to-do-it guy. The book tells you how to do it. Your sponsor will tell you how to do it. I'm not going to sit here and draw a chalkboard. This is how you do the fourth step. This is how you do the eighth step. The eighth step arises from the fourth step. I'm going to go through. I'm going to try to feed you some concepts and stuff on this that maybe you haven't heard before. Okay? Let me read you a couple things and then go through this with you. Okay? First of all, I want to read the story from He Sold Himself Short. Okay? This is the story in the big book. I can read different stories. They're all essentially sort of like the same in what they say. But there's a reason why I want to read you this. So I read it before, and I like reading it, and I'm going to read it again. Okay? This latest part of my life has had a purpose. Not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Oh, by the way, let me start this. You understand that in this meeting, this is not 2013. We're now in 1937. My meetings are all 1937 oriented, except that we're using the big book, which wasn't around in 1937. Here's what happened. AA started in 1935. The big book was written in 1939. Now, I know some of you guys heard this before, but it's being repeated. The big book was written in 1939, after they were 4 years sober. In the big book, they said, you just heard it tonight, they say it at every meeting, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. In other words, we have rarely seen anybody fail who have done the things we did thoroughly. You get the, are we in agreement with that? I mean, the English language, this is a big deal with alcoholics, can we agree on the English language? That when they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, that is the same thing as saying, if you do thoroughly what we did, you'll get what we got. Is that okay with you guys? Okay, well, okay, we start off right there. So here's what you think. You think what they did was they read the big book, and they went to the meetings like we go to today. Now, here's the deal. They did not read the big book. The big book was not around. When they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, they're talking about the path they were following before the big book was written. And in order to find out what they were actually... Now the big book will keep you sober for long periods of time. Yeah, now, the big book was written by sort of like a committee. You know, Bill Wilson put it together, he took it around. You know, there were great arguments about the big book. It's sort of like Congress, you know what I mean? Passing laws. You know, it says the three things people shouldn't see is... three things people should never see is how we make laws, how we make sausages, and how people stay sober. It's all messy and disgusting, okay? Well, imagine this. They passed this first manuscript, which talked all about God and God things and things like that, and they even had the words, honest desire to stay sober. They passed it around a group of people. And there were big arguments. So don't put in the God thing, take out the higher man. They massaged it. And the reason they massaged it was because some of the things were making people uncomfortable. And they wanted to make the funnel wide. They wanted people to be calm. They didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And so they came up with this great book. It's a wonderful book. I study it. I've memorized it. I've used it. It's helped me. But the bottom line is even Bill Wilson referred to AA as a spiritual kindergarten. It's a spiritual kindergarten. We're all here in kindergarten. Here's what happens. After you've been around for 10 or 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, you know, you got to be a grandpa and stuff like that. You sit around and say, man, you know, I think I'd like to leave kindergarten. I mean, I'll come back, you know, I'll hang out here. It's a great place to be. But I'd really like to maybe go to the first grade. You understand and see what that. And so around that time, you start reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And when you read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, you find out that between 1935 and 1939, they were reading the Bible. As a matter of fact, you read a line that they said here, and it says, Dr. Bob, and this is on page 96, this is conference approved. You know, on page 96 says, Dr. Bob noting there were no 12 steps at the time and that our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of, later said that they were convinced that the answer to their problems was in the good book, the Bible. To some of us older ones, the parts we found absolutely essential. That's absolutely essential. You see, alcoholics don't like things like that. They don't like orders. They like to think like everything's suggested. You know what I mean? The parts that they found absolutely essential, which means essential means essential. Essential. That's even stronger than thoroughly, okay? Essential means essential. Absolutely essential means... it's like absolutely essential. You understand? The some we found absolutely essential are Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's a sermon by Jesus Christ. The 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And the book of James. So you read this book, that's what they found absolutely essential. That's why when you see this picture in all the A rooms of Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson sitting with a man on the bed, and they got this book open and they're talking to him. The man on the bed was Bill Dotson. That was the Bible. Now you see, if you listen to the wisdom of the rooms, you think this program has nothing to do with the Bible. You think, as a matter of fact, you think it's against the rules to even mention it. You know what you don't, because that's because you're ignorant. And you're ignorant because people don't want you hearing it or talking about it because it makes them uncomfortable. But you see, around my 25th year, I realized that they can't fire me. They can't say you can't come to AA anymore, so I can say whatever the hell I want to say, you know, right? Stop worrying about what these people are thinking about me. When you're 6 months sober, you worry about that somebody's going to talk behind your back and stuff like that. Now, I get excited when people talk behind my back. I asked my sponsor once, I said, do you still get resentments? He said, get them, I give them. You know, when people are mumbling about you and thinking about you in their cars, they're driving home and hating your guts and all that sort of stuff. Now, of course, I don't even know. I'm walking away going to get a pizza. But, you know, the bottom line is, that makes me feel good. Because they're thinking about me. Because I'm driving them nuts, and I know how AA works. They're either going to forgive me or understand me or do a four-step list, because you know what our spiritual axiom, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with you. They're either going to speak to their sponsor, do a four-step, do something, and somehow or run into something in their life where somehow they're going to figure out what I said, and they're going to come to some sort of conclusion. They're going to say, you know, he's right. And they're going to figure out why I ticked them off. Why am I mad at him? What did he say? What did he actually say? This is the, and they're going to somehow have an epiphany. It may take a day, it may take a week, it may take a month. They're going to work this thing over in their mind if they're working this program, because it's driving them crazy. And then they're going to have an epiphany, and they're going to realize the reason they dislike me is because of the way I said it, because whatever it is, they're going to figure it out, and all of a sudden they're going to realize, hey man, that's the truth. That is the way, you know, he's right. And all of a sudden, when they figure out why I piss them off, they're going to figure out why their ex-wife pisses them off, why the cops piss, they're going to figure out why a whole slew of people, and all of a sudden their life is going to get easier. And they're going to change, and then 6 years from now, they're going to come up to me and say, you know, I used to hate you, but now I love you. And that's the way it works. It works by getting a resentment and saying, why do I get a resentment? Because I feel uncomfortable. I want to drink or kill myself, but I can't drink or kill myself. And so you go to your sponsor, you do the steps, you try to figure it out. You work out the resentment, and all of a sudden you change. That's how we change. We change through pain. We change through suffering. That's how the seventh step works. We don't change sitting on our ass being fat and happy. We change through going through the trial. Before you get the blessings, you must get broken. You get broken before the blessings. A lot of you guys have realized the blessings that are given by being in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the blessings came after you were broken. They don't come before you're broken, because alcoholic nature is to sit on their ass and not want to do anything until they're broken. So it says to some of us older ones, the parts we found absolutely essential were Sermon on the Mount, 13th chapter of Corinthians, and the book of James. So how many people have studied those books? I don't want to see a show of hands. Okay, well, nobody. Okay, I understand. There may be a few people, a couple of people. Well, listen, if they say, rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, and it says these books were absolutely essential, how come we're not studying them? Don't answer that question. I know the answer. You know the answer, too, because people don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. Well, that's fine. They'll get what they get. Because if they said you do what we did, you'll get what we get. If you don't do what they get, you don't think, the book doesn't say you don't do what, you do whatever the hell you want to do, you'll get what we get. So I wanted what they had. So here's a little bit of what they had. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. And over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. Now here we go. Here comes the good part. I am rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great. I don't have a lot of stuff. And you believe that he doesn't have a lot of stuff, This isn't a group. This isn't a fellowship. This isn't a program about getting stuff. But I have a fortune. Here we go. Here's the fortune. Here's the fortune. In friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Something, by the way, alcoholics do not have, by and large, at any point, even after they're sober. You know, the fellowship, you know, to get into the fellowship, all you need is a desire to stop drinking. You know, I came into the first fellowship you come into, the fellowship of the thumb-sucking crybabies. There's another fellowship. You know, there's a sixth step we have here. The sixth step says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Now, I'm not telling you this. This is the truth. There is a separation between the men and the boys. There's a separation between the children and the adults. Man and women. There's a separation here between the children. Trust me. You hang around here long enough, you'll recognize the children and you'll recognize the adults. You'll recognize them. You'll see them. They'll be speaking at meetings. You'll know who they are. And you'll recognize who the adults are. You'll understand that, deal. You're either going to be the adult or you're going to be the child. Now, we all go through that childish phase, that kindergarten phase, but eventually you got to grow up. And this is what the adults look like. But I have a fortune in friendship, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, which means above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man. Here it comes. What would you think a guy from 1935 to 1939 would say? What would he say? What would he say is the greatest thing accorded to any man? The love and understanding of a gracious God. They call me up from North Carolina. They want me to speak at a convention, but they want me to tone it down. I'm serious. They want me to tone it down. They want me to tone it down. They don't want me to talk about the Bible or any of that stuff or the God. They just want me to tone it down. They want to hear some war stories. They want me to entertain. That's what they want me to tickle their ears. They want me to tell them something that people will laugh at dinner and say, boy, wasn't that guy great? They don't want to say anything that would make people think. God forbid I should say something that would get people mad. And I understand that. I get that deal. Just tone it, just water down the chemotherapy a little bit. You know what I mean? Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust, where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and serving them as I can. So here's the only question that you got to ask yourself. Do you want that? Do you want that? That's what they're serving up. That's what we're dishing up in here. It says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you got to be ready. Then you're ready to take certain steps. There's a lot of people coming here, they don't want what we have. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want what they had. They want their old girlfriend. They want their old boyfriend. They want their romance back. They want the cars. They want everything back that they've been chasing before they came here. They don't want to change at all. They just want it all back and not drink. They just want to lose a few pounds. You know what I mean? Stop biting their nails. Get a new dress. A new haircut. Get some breast enhancements. You know what I mean? Take some Viagra. Do something. You know, get physically fit. Join a gym. Get wonderful. Get a guy. Get a girl. Get the romance. They want all that stuff back and then they'll be happy. And they're never happy. Because you want to know something? It takes a lot of effort to keep that thing perfect and going. You don't have enough energy to keep that husband perfect. You don't have enough energy to keep that wife perfect. I thought, you know, when I saw my first Playboy magazine, I knew that a woman would cure me. I knew if I only had her, I'd be okay for the rest of my life. There's a lot of energy, you know, because people aren't perfect. You know, have you ever noticed there's a lot of moving parts out there? People are like doing their own thing, you know, they're like not listening to you. They're misbehaving all the time. You know, if only you were like in charge of the universe and you could kill the people you didn't like and only the ones, you know, all that stuff. It ain't working. It doesn't work. You know, it's like the guy who said to me, he said, oh, I'm feeling great. Why? He says, my restaurant is doing fantastic. I said, well, gee, I hope it always does fantastic. The next week his restaurant didn't make the monthly payroll and he was drinking. Because his happiness depended upon how his restaurant was going, or how his law practice is going, or how his love life is going, or his wife's moods. You know, what happened in the divorce, it depended upon his job, or his boss, because he was running the meetings, because he needed me, because of his boss, because of the world, because of the traffic, because he had a bad week. You want to tie yourself to that stuff? So some people don't want what we have. They want what they had. And some people want what we have, but they're not willing to go to any. They want what we have, but I don't want to hear that God stuff. They're just not willing to do this thing thoroughly. They're just, that's like too far for them. They're not going to get what we got. They're not going to get what he got. So the first thing you got to ask yourself, is that what you want? What that guy was talking about. So here's the deal. Let me talk about a little bit about the eighth and ninth step and how this all sort of focuses in and gets... In order to do that, I'm going to stick on one page in the big book, which you wouldn't think is about the eighth and ninth, but it is. And it's a page on 62, one of my favorite pages, 62, 63, on selfishness and self-centeredness. I want to tell you three stories. I'm going to gloss over these real fast. Okay, there are three. You know, I can do a meeting on just one of these stories. These are three stories about myself, personal stories about myself. This would be like fifth step stuff, you know, but I'm going to just tell you three stories in chronological order. Some of them I've shared with you before, you know, but I'm going to just go through them fast because I want to make a point. When I got that Camaro, remember, did I do the meeting on the Camaro in here? No, that was another group. Okay, well, I got myself a car when I was like 19 years old. The car that I knew was going to change my life. You ever realize something's going to change your life, so you got to have it? So I got the car that was going to change my life, because once I had this car, I was going to be okay, and I would be able to get the girl that would change my life, and I would be perfect, and everything would be wonderful. So I went out, and I spent more money than I made to buy the car, whatever it was, and went in the hole, because it was going to be wonderful. And there's a whole story about the car, you know. I drove it three blocks down Alton Boulevard at 9:30 in the morning. I thought the whole world was looking at me. I was like on top of the world. I was okay now. I was perfect. I stopped at a light. Some 60-year-old guy drove up in a Cadillac, brand new Cadillac with a blonde. Looked at me. I looked at him and I said, man, why can't I have a car like that? It lasted. The feeling of being on top of the world lasted like three blocks, you know what I mean? The payments lasted 36 months. It didn't work, okay? But, you know. And I have pictures. So I went out, I got the car, and then I got the gal. The gal's name was Lynn. She's a blonde gal from New Jersey and the love of my life, which means I essentially captured her and stalked her. You know what I mean? Because it was that true sort of alky love where, you know, you're always thinking about marriage and the kids and you're projecting all that stuff and you got to be with them every second. If they're not with you, you're wondering who they're with and what they're doing. And just total alky lust love. What do you call that? Obsessive, sort of compulsive, like everything's, yeah, I killed 3,000 people, but I'm in love. You know what I mean? It's all about me. And so she's from New Jersey, so she's with me every second of the day. So around Christmas time, her parents, who had spent money to have her come down here, said they would like her to be home for Christmas. You know? So we're having dinner one day, and she says to me, my parents would like me home for Christmas, so I'm going to fly home to be with them for Christmas. I mean, can you imagine? And I an unbelievable, and I love this, I loved her! You're laughing, right? You don't know what it's like, you know. You don't know what it's like to love somebody. Go back home and watch them soap operas. Those novellas, my wife, you know. You'll understand. Watch the Lifetime channel. That'll explain everything, okay? I loved her, you know. And here's the deal. And so she said to me, and you know what happened to me immediately? Because of this incredible love I had for her? An incredible rage took over me. Anger. And I looked and I said, this is what I said. I said, what about me? I said, what about me? What am I supposed to do? What about me? Because you see, the story of me, I'm an alcoholic. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. Trust me, no matter how I act, no matter who I am, it's always only about me. All I give a crap about is me. All I think about is me. It's me. If she leaves me, I'm in a depression. If she's run over by a bus, I'm okay. Because that's a different kind of deal. You understand what I'm saying? If they die, it's not a big deal. But if they leave me, that's a problem. Because it's about me and my feelings. Well, actually, I saw that situation because I bought the ticket to New Jersey and I stalked her up there and I found her. Okay, next story. That's a true story. Now, that's a true story. Okay? Now, let's go to the next deal. The next deal, I'm going to forget, I was going to tell you three things, I'm probably only going to remember two things. The next deal, oh no, I remember three. The next deal is, my wife, I married this wonderful gal, you know, I got a different car, I got the Cadillac, I went out and I bought the Cadillac. I got another gal, a nicer gal, yeah, beautiful gal, beautiful woman, I married her, beautiful parents, had a beautiful child, had a beautiful house. I'm going to the bar, I'm looking at the other women. I got tired of my wife. I got tired of it. You know, I got tired. I got bored. You know, I was restless. I was there. I was looking around. I wanted to have sex with another woman. I wanted to go out with another woman. You know what I mean? I started feeling uncomfortable in my marriage. So I told her I wanted a divorce. 5 years, you know, I'm 5 years, you know, into the marriage, and I wanted a divorce. I mean, you know, I mean, we made a mistake. I made a mistake. You know, I mean, what are you crying for? I mean, I'll pay you child support. I mean, I'm doing the right thing. I want a divorce. I mean, we weren't right for each other. She didn't understand me. She didn't want me to go to the bar. She didn't want me to drink. She was hampering my life. Stop, I want a divorce. Stop crying. I want a divorce. What's the big deal? And so I left her. You know, she said one day, you know, I came home drunk one time, and I left her. I just acted crappy enough, and I drank enough, so she divorced me because I was too chicken to get divorced. I'd have her finally file divorce against me because of the way I acted, because she had something called self-esteem, whatever that is, and she divorced me. And I left her. And as I'm walking away from my house and my wife, because I didn't have the integrity to, you know, stick by there because I wasn't a man, I was a child, and it was all about me and my feelings. What about me? What about my feelings? You know what I mean? As I'm walking in my car, I'm thinking, I'm free. I'm free. I'm not even thinking about that. Okay? Now, the third story. It's 2 years down the road. My son is around 7 years old now. I have visitation rights. And I promised to take him to the zoo on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. I was to pick him up, take him to the zoo. I was the division chief of the state attorney's office. I was an attorney. I mean, I am an attorney in the state attorney's office. I was supervising people, trying first-degree murder cases. I mean, I was not drunk off the side of the road. And I went out with some gal named Sally the night before, Friday night. And, you know, I woke up in the morning, fully intent to take my son to the zoo like I promised him. He was waiting for me. Taking me. He said, "We're going to the zoo, Dad?" He says, "Yeah, I'm going to take you to the zoo. I promise you I'll be there." And Sally called me up and said, "Hey, listen, me and the girls are going out on the boat. Would you like to go out with us on the boat?" I'm thinking, my son, the zoo, Sally, the boat, booze, sex, you know, all that sort of stuff. My son, the zoo, you know. I'm like agonizing over this decision. You know what I mean? It's like Syria. You know what I mean? I don't know what to do. You know, I'm agonizing. I'm like, oh man. It's like, oh, I must have agonized over this for, I don't know what, 30 seconds? And it was anchors away. I went out on the boat with Sally. I didn't even call him up. You know, I didn't even, oh, stop it. What are you? You're an alcoholic. I mean, why don't you do a four-step and figure out what the hell you've been doing with your life. Don't worry about me. So I didn't even call him up. I said, why should I go? You know something? Here's what I'm thinking. He'll have a better time. He wouldn't have a good time with me. He'll have a better time with his mother. You know what I mean? I didn't even call him up. And you know, you see, I'm on the boat. You know what I mean? And I got on the boat and I'm drinking. And there's some little voice, I'm sure, deep down inside of me that's saying, you are some sort of piece of shit. You know what I mean? But that's okay. If you drink enough, that voice will go away. And you can think about how wonderful you are and what a great guy you are. Now here's the deal I want you to understand. Now, here's the thing. I just told you three stories I remember that are absolutely true in stories of my life. The things that I did to people that ripped their hearts out and changed their lives. And I'm going to tell you something right now. I honestly do not believe that there's any amends I could possibly make in this lifetime that would totally repair that damage. I mean, I would like to think I can pay the child support, call him up. Now, I have a great relationship with my son now. I made amends to my wife. I made amends to my ex-wife. I made amends to my son. I did the thing. We have a relationship. But the truth is, okay, I did the eighth step. I did the ninth step. But here's the truth. The truth is, if I'm going to be honest to myself, that despicable behavior, which caused unbelievable damage, I will never know what that deal would have been like. Now, she married another man who was a non-alcoholic, a wonderful guy. He raised my son. Now, I will never know. If I wasn't drinking, if I wasn't an active alcoholic, if I had stayed in that marriage and done the right thing and been with that, I'd never know what that relationship would be like, you know, what my relationship would be with my son if I should. I'll never be able to say, well, I repaired that deal. You know, I made that thing like it never happened. I mean, I did real damage there. Now, here's the thing you got to understand. Those three things I told you about, that's not like three unusual things. That's three things I happen to remember in my life. That's like my pattern. That's how I thought. What about me? That's how I made decisions. I'm sure there's about 10,000 things I've left out that I haven't even thought about because that's just the way I was. I did whatever the hell I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it. I didn't give a crap about anybody. And if I was doing something I didn't want to do, it's because you had a gun to my head or the judge ordered me to do it or something happened, but I didn't like it and I was in a bad mood because of it. You understand what I'm saying? Now, here's the real crazy thing about that. Every one of those decisions I made that had to do with what I wanted to do, I made them cold, stone, sober. cold, stone, sober. When I decided not to pick up my son, I was sober. You understand what I'm saying? When I said to my wife I wanted a divorce, I was sober. When I flew up to Lynn Benson and stalked her down and was had a big rage and said, what about me? I was sober. I mean, I'd love to be able to say to you, okay, that I just did this because I was drinking. I heard people because I drink, and it's alcohol's fault. It's not my fault. Alcohol had nothing to do with it, okay? I did it because that's the kind of worthless bum I was. I may have been wearing a three-piece suit. That's the kind of despicable, worthless bum I was. And the bottom line is, the only thing I hurt, most of the people I hurt cold, stone, sober because of my selfish, self-centered attitude. And I've hurt many people, many of the same ways, after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in program. So you want, and the only thing alcohol allowed me to do was live with my sorry ass self without the guilt, seemingly without the guilt, while I was doing it. While I was doing it, being in denial. So somehow, and I'll tell you something, if you don't understand, and if you don't, and you know something, the longer I'm sober, the more I realize how despicable some of the things were I did and how much it hurts people. Not the less I'm sober, because you know one of the things, one of the consequences of alcoholism, remember, you'll be precarious, and one of the consequences of alcoholism is you don't even see yourself. You don't even know yourself. You have no clue who you are. You think you're it's a bunch of bad breaks, and you think you're a victim. You think you're a victim. They hurt you. It's not my fault. You don't understand. Yes, but. You would have done it too. You don't know what happened. I'm a yes butter, and you don't understand her, and I'm a victim, and that's my deal. And that's the way I think. You know what 1 Corinthians 13 says? See, if you study that, it says, he says, when I was a child, I thought like a child. When I became a man, I put childish things away. We see through a glass darkly, but soon we'll be revealed, and we'll see ourselves just like God will see us. It's all about actually becoming, how are you going to make amends? How are you going to, listen, the first step in getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. How many years did it take you to admit that you might have a drinking problem? How many years is it going to take for you to admit that you hurt a lot of people? That it wasn't just a no big deal or anything like that. There's a lot of people that were affected. It's very hard to make amends to people. It's very even hard to even know you need to make amends to people. You know, I said to my, unless you know what they are, what you did. I said to my sponsor, it says we're restless, irritable, discontented. One of the reasons I'm restless is because I feel guilty. Because I have this guilt locked down inside. You know, if you don't think you have guilt, then you're going to have to ask yourself why you always tell yourself you're a piece of shit. I know you're alcoholics. I know how you talk to yourself. I know how you accuse yourself. I know how you think you don't deserve to live. I know how anything, something happens that's bad, you think you're a failure. How you never get this thing. I know how you talk to yourselves. I know what you think about yourselves. I know your opinion of you. And what you say to yourself about you, where do you think that's coming from? Like Venus? There's nobody, that's you telling you about you because of the shit that's inside of you, and it's going on night and day, 24/7, whether you hear it or not. And you know, that kind of crap that you that's why you don't have the self-assurance, that's why you don't have the self-esteem, that's why you don't have some of the stuff that this guy has, that's why you don't have the courage. That's why you feel the way you feel about yourself. That's why you're restless, irritable, and distant. That's why you're always looking for something to sort of make you feel okay. Because, you know, it's just like Carl Menninger said in his book, Man Against Himself. Alcoholics are out to destroy themselves. Because if you did that because of all the things you did and the things you feel, that's why you feel about the way about yourself the way you feel. That's why you talk to yourself the way you talk to yourself. In the shower, in the car, whatever it is. So how are you going to, sure, you can stop the drinking. How are you going to stop the thinking? How are you going to stop that crap? How are you going to do that stuff? You know, that's what, and you know, I said to my sponsor once, I said, you know, I feel guilty. He says, well, maybe that's because you are guilty. Hey, time to get another sponsor, you know what I mean? This guy doesn't understand. What happened to love and, you know, love is our code, you know what I mean? Love and compassion is our code or whatever, you know? What is he making, trying to make me feel bad? Well, you want something? You got to feel bad before you feel good. You got to be broken before, you know, in the book of Corinthians, one of the things, one of the greatest lines that the Apostle Paul said, he said, worldly sorrow leads to death, godly sorrow leads to salvation. Worldly sorrow leads to death. God, I know what worldly sorrow is. That's feeling sorry for yourself. That's self-pity. I am the emperor of self-pity. I am the world's expert on self-pity. I am a self-pityaholic. Anything that happens anywhere in the planet Earth, on the universe, in the Milky Way, and beyond, interstellar space, that happens, as long as it's within 18,000 light years of me, is something I can feel sorry for myself about, like at the drop of a hat. pour me a drink. Leads to my death, leads to my demise. My whole life was earmarked by feeling sorry for myself and thinking I'm a victim of bad breaks and misunderstanding I'm a victim. It just launched me in the direction of death. One night in December, one early morning, Christmas morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, December of 1980, I fell down on my knees because I didn't have, for the first time in my life, I didn't have worldly sorrow. I didn't feel sorry for myself. You know what I did? I felt sorry for what I had become. I felt sorry for what I had become. You know, when you stop feeling sorry for yourself and you start feeling sorry for what you had become, and I got down my knees and I asked God for help because I was ashamed of myself and I was ashamed for what I had become. I didn't blame anybody else. There was no feeling like I was a victim. I wasn't mad at anybody. I was just sorry to God for what I had become, and I asked Him to help me. And it all started there. It all started from there. A month later, I said, God help me, on the hospital bed. A week after that, I picked up my white chip and I stopped drinking. It's all, but what had to happen to me to get me in that point where I stopped feeling sorry for myself and started feeling sorry for what I had become? You know, there's a great line that I heard, and I've stolen 90% of my lines, but I stole this one because of the truth. He said, I stopped drinking when the consequences of my drinking came at me faster than my ability to lower my standards. You know, no matter how bad I got, I could lower my standards enough to say I was okay. You know, or hang around people that were worse than me. And so what happens? When do you first learn about what you really did to hurt people? Isn't it in the fourth step? That's when you start realizing, you start writing down the people you've hurt and what you've done. Of course, they fool you, say write down the resentment. So you write down all the people you hate. But then by the time they get the false, by the time you get through the whole fourth step, you start realizing all the crap that you've done. What did you do to cause these things? And then you do a fifth step and you start learning more. And it's at the eighth and ninth step where we finally see what's going on and who we hurt and what we had, that we have an opportunity to try to make those amends, to attempt to make those amends, you know what I mean, to those people that we have harmed. And I got to tell you something, if not calling up my son, and I believe this to be true. You ever hear about the, you know that thing, The Portrait of Dorian Gray? You know, I don't know how many people read that novel, Edgar Allan Poe, right? It's a novel that said this guy, Dorian Gray, and he looked gorgeous, but he had this portrait, and every time he did something evil, every time he did something wicked, there was like a mark on that portrait. Well, listen, I have some sort of portrait inside of me. No matter how good I look on the outside, no matter how well I look on the outside, every evil thing I did, everything I did that hurt somebody, somewhere deep down inside, there's like a mark that says, you are a piece of crap. You see, that's why I couldn't look you in the eyes. That's why I could never do a meeting like this. Because if you did a meeting like this, you understand what I'm saying? I'd have to talk to you. I'd have to look in my eyes. And you'd be able to see what the deal is. And I know what the deal is. I'm a piece of crap. And I wouldn't be able to fake you. I wouldn't be able to talk like this and be transparent with you. That's why I'm worried so much about what other people think about me. Because of course I'm worried about what they think about me. Because I think I'm a piece of crap. And they're going to think I'm a piece of crap. So I assume they think and they can see I'm a piece of crap. And that's the way I go through life. But you want to know something? As I start making these amends and start living my life a different way, you know, with the guidance maybe of a sponsor and of a group and things like that, and I start doing things different, you know what happens? That portrait that's deep inside of me, it starts getting erased a little bit. And I don't become sinless, but, you know, as a good friend of mine, one of my mentors, a Baptist preacher, says, I sin less. So believe me, I'm anything but perfect, but I'm a lot better than I used to be. And all of a sudden, you know, every once in a while, I still get those thoughts. I'd be lying, but there's a difference when you get them once a month for 1 minute, and every other day, you know, you screwed up, you're an idiot, what are you, stupid, you love you, you know, that kind of thing. But you want to know something? Most of the thoughts I get sound like this. You know, you're a good guy. You're trying to do God's will. You're okay, Russ. You're doing okay. You know what happens to you and how you act and how you feel about yourself when you're getting those thoughts about how you're okay and you're a good guy and you're doing the right thing?
and they supplant the other thoughts, I'll tell you what, you don't have any bad weeks. You don't have any bad days. You may have like a bad 2 minutes, you know, that kind of deal. So it's well worth the deal to go after that thing. You understand what I'm saying? That's what the eighth and ninth step is all about. That's what it'll give you. That's what it gives you. That's how it helps. And of course, you know, with the alcohol doesn't even come into the picture, because when you're feeling good about yourself, when you got that thing, you know, that guy, that thing, that story I read about on that guy, you know, where I've been lifted from the scrap heap. When you have that great, you know, seated within your relationship with him is riding great events. When you have those great events coming, happening to you, you know what I mean? What are you going to drink about when you're feeling, why drink when you're feeling that good? Selfishness, self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of fellows, they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some point in the past we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in the position to be hurt. So we think our troubles are basically of our own making. They arise out of self. Alcohol is an extreme example of self-will. I'm self-will run riot. I'm buying that ticket. I'm going to New Jersey. Above everything, we must get rid of self or it kills us. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. He's all-powerful. He provides what we need if we keep close to him and do his work well. Established on that footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. How would you like that, too? I mean, really, how would you like that? You really want what you? I mean, it's nice to pick up a chip. I mean, it's great. It's great, you know, to pick up a medallion. You know, everybody claps that. Let me tell you something. There's a lot of people picking up medallions. They don't have that deal. There's a lot of people with 15 and 20 years. They don't have that deal. They're picking up medallions. They don't have that deal. They're going to meetings. They're not drinking, but they don't have that deal. You got to decide what you want in here. You got to get that vision for you. You know what I mean? Get that vision of what's going on here. Okay? God bless you. Thank you very much.